You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
I want to add my thanks to Larry for joining us. I think Larry gave you a sense of what it's like to sit in a policy discussion with him, which I had the pleasure of doing over 20 years ago. And Larry, thank you for being with us. It's always educating and illuminating. So thank you, Larry, and Bob, too, for the conversation. We'll bring up the next panel. And while doing so, I see in the audience Tom Donilon, who I think is the only person I know of who has been a trustee of both the Miller Center and the Brookings Institution. So it's a particular pleasure to have you with us today, Tom. The next panel and our final one is Financial Crises in a Comparative Perspective. And it's we're planning to cover a lot of ground, including how does this crisis compare to others around the world throughout time, and how does the U.S. experience during the crisis compare to that of other countries during this last crisis. Joining us on the panel, please come on up, are Jeffrey Frieden, the professor of government at Harvard University, who specializes in the politics of the international monetary and fiscal relations. Graciela Kaminsky, professor of economics and international affairs at GW University here in D.C., a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Carmen Reinhart, who is the Minos Zumbanakis professor of international financial system at Harvard's Kennedy School, who's held positions as a chief economist and vice president at the investment bank of Bear Stearns in the 80s. Linda Tessar, professor of economics at the University of Michigan, a research associate also at NBER. And this one will also be moderated by Bob Bruner. And if you missed the previous panel, Bob is the Dean Emeritus at the Darden School of Business and a professor there still, as well as a senior faculty fellow at the Miller Center at UVA. So, Bob, back over to you.
Thank you very much, Bill. Welcome back, everybody. A very, very brief introduction would just be to say that the aspiration, the mission of this final panel is to look across the world. Again, cross-sectional comparisons. Think about how did the U.S. fare compare to other places, as well as over time. How did the most recent crisis compare to earlier crises? And I think our panelists are wonderfully situated, both in terms of their research and teaching, for helping to illuminate that. Let me call on our panelists in the order in which they were introduced and ask Jeffrey Frieden to begin with his remarks.
Well, thanks very much, Bob. It's a great pleasure to be here. For those of us who I think actually is all of us up on the panel who study debt crises, for whom crises are our business, and business is always good, one thing that was striking about the 2008-2009 financial crisis, both in the U.S. and in Europe, is how similar it was in so many ways to debt crises that we had come to know and study and maybe even love around the world, whether it was Argentina or Mexico or Thailand, the East Asian crisis or the Mexico peso crisis. There were many extraordinary characteristics. It was the first major debt crisis that involved a whole series of developed industrial countries, the first crisis, as far as I know, debt crisis in a monetary union. But in many ways, it was a typical result of a classic capital flow cycle in which capital floods into a country with very predictable results. You get a big payments deficit, you get a big upsurge in asset prices, a big increase in the price of non-tradable goods and services, especially housing. The expansion that's as a result of this inflow of capital turns into a boom, which turns into a bubble, which eventually bursts. It's what's happened over and over and over again, as Carmen and Ken Rogoff's book so aptly demonstrates. For those of you who don't know it, it's called This Time is Different. The subtitle reveals the sardonic nature of the title, which is 8 centuries of financial folly. And the book shows how over hundreds of years this kind of capital flow cycle is repeated and repeated and repeated. There's another aspect of the crisis of 2008-2009, which is so reminiscent of things that those that American and European economists have been telling developing countries for at least a century, which is if you borrow, and especially if you borrow abroad, make sure you do it for productive purposes. And most of all, don't borrow for current consumption. And it turns out that was very good advice because we did it and got into trouble as a result. So the fact that this was, in many ways, a classic debt crisis helps explain why the recovery was as troubled as it was, because we know something about that from both history and theory. In economic terms, the debt crisis leaves the society in question with a debt overhang, with a burden of accumulated debts that have to be dealt with. Creditors with, in this case, trillions of dollars of debts that they know are bad and other trillions that they think might be bad are primarily concerned to restore the quality of their balance sheet, and they're not lending new loans, especially to risky borrowers. Debtors have experienced spells of unemployment, declines in wages, other problems. They still have their debts. The only way they can service their outstanding debts is by tightening their belts, whether as nations or as individuals, and that means they're not spending, so banks aren't lending, consumers aren't spending, and the recovery takes much longer. I think your estimate was 5 to 8 years in a debt crisis in normal times, so we were right on track. There's a political aspect of debt crises that we saw in this one, as we've seen in others, and that is that every debt crisis that I know of ends up almost immediately in massive political conflict. And the political conflict is over how the burden of adjustment will be distributed. Who's going to pay the price? Who's going to make the sacrifices to deal with this enormous burden of outstanding, largely bad debts? This is on one dimension in the case, especially in Europe, where it's an international debt crisis. There's an international dimension. You have creditor countries that want to get paid back, don't want their banks to fail, debtor countries that want some debt relief. So you have Germans against Spaniards, Dutch against Greeks. Then within countries, there's a question of how within a particular country, whether a debtor country or a creditor country, who's going to make the sacrifices necessary to pay debt service or to do the debt relief that's necessary? Is it going to be the financial institutions? Is it going to be government employees? Is it going to be taxpayers, consumers, the private sector, the public sector? And we saw that over and over again. And in fact, we still see it. The aftermath of the crisis is still going on in many European countries as political conflict over how the burden of adjustment will be distributed. How good was the response in broad comparative perspective? I think there are two components of that. The first is macroeconomic. The second is distributional. In macroeconomic terms, I think the immediate monetary policy response was quite reasonable. The Europeans took longer to get on board, but generally we had, as we've been hearing most of the day, a fairly good monetary policy response. The longer-term adjustment measures, I think the fiscal stimulus in the U.S. certainly helped. It wasn't enough, and it lasted far too short. The longer-term response in Europe was absolutely abysmal. There was no stimulus. In fact, there was there was austerity measures imposed, which worsened the crisis. There was a very weak response to the underlying debt burden. In both instances, in my view, there was insufficient debt restructuring. In the U.S., there was some, both privately and through government policies. In the European Union, where it was clear from the start that the only way to really move forward through this crisis would be to restructure many of these debts, the only restructuring that took place was in Greece, where it was inevitable. And so the European crisis is not over. And the reason it's not over is that the member states of the European Union have been completely unable to come to any consensus on how to restructure the debts that accumulated over the 10 years that led up to the crisis. So I suppose on the macroeconomic front, the U.S. did okay, not great. Europe did abysmally and continues to do abysmally. On the distributional front, things are even more disastrous. And here I think we have to understand that in many ways the crisis is ongoing because the current upsurge of populist sentiment and the backlash against globalization was not caused by the crisis. It's caused by 40 years of continuing problems and of broader trends in social and economic variables, but the crisis was a massive catalyst that stimulated a lot of the populist upsurge that we're seeing today. The distributional effects of the crisis and of the run-up were disastrous. The boom had very unequal effects. The crisis had even more unequal effects, and the recovery had some of the most unequal effects, especially in Europe, where you have Greece is still about 5 years from being where it was before the crisis. And we've talked about the impact in the U.S. To me, people talk about what's the best summary statistic. The best summary statistic to me is median household income. That's the middle class. Median household income in the U.S. has barely gotten back to where it was before the crisis. In the prosperous states like New York, Massachusetts, California, it's pretty much above. This is when the economy is 15 or 20% bigger. In states like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, in many instances, it's still below. So we are still suffering from the aftermath of the crisis. The middle class has not recovered in very simple terms, in terms of median household income. Median household wealth, by the way, according to Ed Wolf, is 35% below where it was when the crisis began. So that's in the U.S. Europe is much worse off, where you have entire regions, mostly all of southern Europe, which have not come close to recovering from the crisis. So why did we not learn? Why, you know, after, I mean, the book was not published till 2009, but they should have learned something from the book, and some of the articles were out beforehand. Because, I mean, to be blunt about it, learning has very little to do with it. It's about politics, not about learning. And politics in a debt crisis has to do with agreement, reaching a politically sensible, a politically plausible, a politically feasible agreement, both on the specific macroeconomic management of the crisis and, much more importantly, I think, on how the distribution of the burden will be taken. That is, who's going to bear the price for dealing with this accumulation of bad debts that society has built up over time. Have the politics changed? So if as I believe, how we deal with a crisis depends on the underlying politics, we have to want to believe that the politics might have changed. And in fact, I think that they've gotten worse. That in the U.S., we've seen increasing polarization which is an impediment even to the normal function of American government, that if there were to be a crisis today, I would anticipate an even greater political polarization over how to deal with it than we had in the aftermath of the 2008-2009 crisis. In Europe, I think, again, there has been some progress towards more cooperative risk sharing, but even in Europe, we see ever greater polarization within countries over how to deal with normal economic times. So I'm very worried about what the politics of an eventual crisis, if it were to recur, would be like, because I think that today we live in a world of great polarization both within countries and across countries, and polarization of the type that we have seen in the U.S. and elsewhere is a massive impediment to dealing sensibly with an economic crisis. All of the technical preparation in the world cannot overcome political obstacles of the sort that we are now experiencing, which makes me very worried about the future. On that happy note, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you for inviting me. As you know, this session is about comparisons. So, Jeff, I have talked about Europe, I have talked about the United States. I would like to instead focus on the periphery, but the emerging periphery. Not only the emerging periphery, but I would also like to look at a long-term analysis of financial crisis and what happened, what was the aftermath. So what I'm going to be looking at is a 200 years of histories of booms and busts in capital flows and financial crisis in the financial center. My emerging periphery is going to be Latin America. Why Latin America? Well, Latin America has been always in international capital markets, so it's very important to look at the booms and busts, how much they borrow, and how these borrowing bonanzas ended. Latin America was, after independence, was right in international capital markets borrowing. The first time that they issued a bond was in 1820, and they continued borrowing, okay, until the collapse of international capital markets after the Great Depression in 1931. And then when financial globalization restarted following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, Latin America was again borrowing and having crisis. And so it's very interesting. It gives a rich experience to examine what are the links between financial crisis in the financial center and cycles in the rest of the world, and in particular in the emerging periphery. And I think that Carmen afterwards is going to talk about Europe and exactly Linda is also going to be talking about Europe. One question, you know, we're economists. We want to give figures, but I will try to eliminate the figures that give an idea of what was going on back then and what is important to examine 200 years of history. The first episode of financial globalization is very different from the second episode of financial globalization. During the first episode of financial globalization, there was the gold standard. The policies that the financial center could do were very limited. You cannot do monetary policy when you are fixing the value of your own currency to, in this particular case, to gold. You cannot do cyclical monetary policy. In contrast, we are now out of the gold standard. The financial center can be a lender of last resort, can be also do cyclical monetary policy. So it's important to see these two characteristics when we are examining the how financial crises in the financial center end and how they affect the rest of the periphery. So far, we have looked, when we are talking about the crisis in the financial center, we have looked at 2008. It's important to see, okay, what happens when there are other crises in the financial center. And so it's important, these are rare disasters, and so it's important to have a long perspective. So that's why during the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, we have many panics in the financial center, starting in London in 1825, continuing in 1873 in continental Europe, and so on and so forth, until we had the Great Depression in the 1930s. So that's what I'm going to compare. I'm going to compare what was happening, what is happening now, what was happening back then. Okay. So what happened after the crisis in 2008 in the United States? Well, everybody has talked about the slow return to normality, the lagging growth rates in economic activity. It took time. Okay, for countries around the world, okay, to return to some tranquil times growth rates, and many countries haven't still, okay, returned to those growth rates as we have observed in tranquil times. So the same thing happened in the periphery. The growth rates before the crisis in 2008, the economy were growing fast, and then they collapsed. And the collapse, the growth rates haven't returned to what they were before. The collapse in economic activity, you can measure with GDP, you can measure looking at exports of those countries. Those two measures give exactly the same dimension. Was this crisis different? Okay, from crises in the past in Latin America? Yes, when you're looking, for example, at the 1990s, the evolution, okay, of the crisis and then the upturn of these economies following the crisis was much faster. These were tranquil times. The financial center was very liquid. The economy, the international economy was growing. And the aftermath of the panics, the booms and busts in capital flows in Latin America was very different on economic activity. This is similar to what we observed in the 1980s, okay, with the boom and bust in borrowing in Latin America. And the problem, the banking crisis in the United States, generated by the lending, the international lending of larger commercial banks to the rest of the periphery and funneling, okay, capital through of OPEC to the emerging periphery. In those times, too, what we observe is a large collapse in economic activity in the periphery following the crisis. And the question now is, was it always the same? When we have a crisis in the financial center, okay, there is a much more protracted collapse in the periphery. And what are the channels of transmission? Okay, when you look at booms and busts in Latin America in the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, you observe a similar pattern, okay, of booms and busts back then and right now, when there is a crisis in the financial center. So what you observe is that bonanzas were very large, and after the collapse, after the crisis in the financial center, economic activity sharply declined. So the collapse in the growth rate in these economies in Latin America was much more dramatic, and as measured by the growth rate of exports on those economies, we don't have GDP for those episodes, the collapse was about 10 percentage points. So it was very dramatic. When you are looking at all the other booms and bust episodes in Latin America in the 19th century and 20th century, when there was nothing happening in the financial center, the world economy was in a tranquil episode, what you observe is that, in general, what you observe is that there is a boom during the bonanzas in capital flows. There is a slowdown in economic activity after the peak of the capital flow cycle, but the economy returns to tranquil times. So the question is, okay, why are these similarities between these two episodes back then and right now, when the financial center, what the financial center was doing back then and right now, they are very different? Okay, and I would like to focus a little bit on that. Okay, so when you're looking at this first episode of financial globalization, when there is a panic in the financial center, the financial center didn't have any ability to follow a policy of lender of last resort. There was no cyclical monetary policy. It could not ease monetary policy because the domestic currency was fixed, had a fixed price vis-a-vis the gold. So with no intervention, when you have a crisis in the financial center, suddenly there is a complete disruption in international capital markets. International capital markets, after a panic, let's say, in 1825 in London, completely disappeared. For many years, there was no access to international liquidity. Okay, and suddenly what do emerging markets do? They don't have access to international capital flows, to new loans, so they defaulted. So a crisis in the financial center back then was accompanied by waves of defaults. So we have waves of defaults in the periphery in the 1820s. We have a new wave of defaults in the 1870s. We have a wave of defaults in the 1890s. And then you all know this, okay, the waves of defaults following the crisis in the United States in 1829 to the Great Depression. Okay, this crisis, okay, these defaults in many cases were protracted and went very long, with no ability whatsoever to tap international capital markets, then the periphery collapsed. But now we say we have a different regime. What is going on that when we are looking at real economic activity before and after a crisis in the financial center, the economy collapses nonetheless? Okay, so now what we have is not only a lender of last resort in the financial center, but we also have, okay, cyclical monetary policy. And cyclical monetary policy we do, and is much more drastic around a crisis in the financial center. So when we are looking at the crisis in 2008, what we have is that as we move into the start of the crisis, there was a sharp, okay, hiking of interest rates, and once the crisis exploded in 2008, what we have is a lot of injection of liquidity at that time. And that increase in liquidity in the United States starting in 2010 is spread out to the rest of the world. And one interesting thing that you see is that with all this liquidity, countries start, okay, borrowing a lot, and leverage increases. A similar episode happened in the 1980s. In the 1980s, we have a commercial banking crisis, so triggered by a drastic monetary policy in the 1970s. And when the crisis erupted in 1981. We also have an very expansionary monetary policy, a sharp decrease in the Fed funds rate. Okay, and again, there was an injection of liquidity, not only in the United States, but also to the countries that have defaulted. The injection of liquidity took a different way, okay, involuntary lending by the banks to Latin American countries and countries in Africa and Eastern Europe, and all the countries that were in the midst of a major solvency problem. And so what you observe is that during a long episode until the Brady Plan was introduced, we have an increase in leverage, an increase in indebtedness of all these countries. So what you see is that in the two episodes of financial globalization, different policies were implemented. Well, one thing that was common in the two episodes of financial globalization is that there was no restructuring and there was an increase in indebtedness of all these countries. And when you see this increase in indebtedness, this slows down economic activity. And this is what we have seen not just in 2008, in the 1980s, but we have seen during the first episode of financial globalization. And so the question is this too much liquidity, too much of a good thing? And so I guess that I stop it here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. So what I'd like to do is continue the themes that already Jeff and Graciela have started. I'm going to talk a little bit about differences and similarities across crises in the run-up to the crisis. This is something that Larry brought up in the earlier session. I'm going to talk about the aftermath and how the aftermath in the U.S. So this goes back to a lot of the, and how the aftermath in the U.S. compared to the aftermath in Europe. And then true to the title of this conference, I'm going to conclude with some commentary on lessons and what lies ahead. Let me start with the bad news. I think the gist of my commentary is we haven't really finished the last crisis and we're starting new ones. So the topic of this conference is certainly as Graciela and I mentioned in our, or wrote in our earlier paper, which referred to Kindleberger, a hardy perennial. And so let me start with the antecedents. This has to do with Larry's comments earlier. He mentioned the fact that before the crisis, there was a lot of looking the other way. And we've heard this from both Graciela and Jeff. The classic, I mean, each crisis has its own features, but the classic feature of the crisis is it takes a really good party to have a good crisis. So you have a boom period, a period of excesses, and indebtedness builds up. Sometimes it's private indebtedness. It could be the households, it could be the banks, it could be the firms or a combination of these, it could be the government, or it could be, again, a combination of all. In the U.S., this time around, in the 2008, it was largely households and the finance, non-corporate. Non-financial corporate business was not the source of the problem. At the time, the government was not the source of the problem. That doesn't mean that that can change for the next round. If you look at Greece, both private and public sectors were borrowing a lot in the run-up to the crisis. So you had a combination of a sovereign debt problem and a private debt problem. Now, let's not get overly technical. One common thread also of what happens in a crisis is that if before the crisis you have a private debt problem, but not a public debt problem. This is Ireland. This is Spain. Ireland, Spain had debt levels before the crisis in the 20s and 30s as a percent of GDP, exceptionally low by historic metrics and international metrics. But private, what was private debt before the crisis became public debt after the crisis. So let's not get too technical on the division between public and private, because in the after the crisis, a lot of it ends up in public hands. So where was the U.S. relative to these other countries? Well, there were the common themes were, and we've heard this, and ditto for the crises in Latin America that Graciela has talked about. You had the over-indebtedness, the buildup of debts, the buildup of leverage, and that buildup of leverage is often fueled by borrowing from abroad. So current account deficit in the U.S., not surprisingly, hit a record just before the global financial crisis, but it pales in comparison to the fact that Iceland had a deficit, current account deficit, greater than 20% of GDP, and Greece had one greater than 15% of GDP. So the borrowing was both domestic and borrowing from the rest of the world. So that's where we were in 2008, a lot of private indebtedness, an asset price bubble, and in many countries in the periphery of Europe, something that Graciela and I wrote about in our Twin Crisis paper 20 years ago, there was a loss of competitiveness. Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal were not competitive vis-a-vis Germany. And part of the current account problem, why they had such huge deficits, wasn't just that they were over-borrowing, but also that their exports were suffering as well. So that's sort of the common ground. The U.S. was not quite in the extreme of the current account deficits, not quite in the extremes of the asset price increases. Ireland and Iceland took the cake on that one. But it was really way up there on the private sector leverage, the household leverage relative to historic norms. So the crisis erupts, and a common theme is that the legacy is a long one. In work that I did with Ken Rogoff in 2004, and then I keep updating all the time, we looked at the worst 100 banking crises since the 1850s. And worse in a very pedestrian way. This is just looking at per capita income and ask the question, how long does it take you? How long does it take a country to get from the pre-crisis level of per capita income back to that pre-crisis level? How many years does it take? The answer to that question is, on average, for the worst 100 crises, is about 7 years. About 7 years. Any guesses, if one looks at the 11 advanced economy crises that we had? The 11 include the U.S., the U.K., they include, you know, the famous cases Italy, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, Iceland, but they also include financial crises, not as deep, but in Germany, in the Netherlands, in France. And how long do you think, on average, it took for per capita income to get back to the pre-crisis, to the 2000? Any guesses? 10 years. 10 years. For the U.S., it took us between 5 and 6 years, which is about the norm, to be fair, after systemic crises. If you look for the U.S., if you look at U.S. crises from 1815 to the present, it's, you know, there are not that many systemic crises. But on average, it takes about between 5 and 6 years, which is what it took this time. But let me put it this way. If you believe the IMF's forecast the WEO forecast, which goes out to 2023, and you use their numbers, neither Italy nor Greece in 2023 will still be back to their 2007 level of income. Those crises, and Jeff pointed that out, are not over. Okay, so that's the, when I said I had bad news that the crises aren't over and we have new ones brewing. So on the part that it's not over is the other legacy of the crisis besides the very slow recovery is a debt overhang. And the issue that I think we keep not learning is that sooner or later, debt overhangs have to be resolved with debt restructuring. And it's a pill that is hard to swallow, and creditors hate it, but debtors need it. And so it takes a long time. So I think that when all is said and told, Greece will not be the only country having a debt restructuring. You can tell me how Italy's going to get out of this one without. So that's the legacy part. Now, Graciela raised really important points about the periphery. The periphery, I was expecting, and turned out to be completely wrong, I was expecting, my God, you know, when the U.S. and the advanced economies crashed in 2008, 2009, I said, my God, the emerging markets are going to go as well. Well, one big thing that I would like to highlight as that made emerging markets more resilient at the time was they had very low levels of external debt. They had delevered a lot. They were very competitive. They had current account surpluses. For Latin American countries to run current account surpluses is a rarity. And most countries had a surplus. They were competitive, low levels of debt. They were very resilient. That's not where we are now. Conditions in emerging markets have deteriorated significantly, largely in part because the legacy of the crisis was also a period of a very long period of very low interest rates, which was an inducement for many of these countries to borrow. And whether it's the private sector, like in Chile or Turkey, or the public sector like Brazil, there's been a lot of borrowing. There's a lot of emerging market debt. And finally, on the crises to come, or the crises that are here, we don't really know it, which is, I think, more accurate, is what Graciela was talking about. This is the missing defaults that typically after a wave of banking crises or crises in the financial centers, what you typically see is a wave of defaults in the periphery countries. We haven't seen that this time. I think part of it is we're not measuring them really well. A lot of the defaults are to China. And that's a completely new ballgame. I don't have time to go into here, but a lot of the surge in lending to the low-income countries, to the commodity-producing low-income countries, has come from China. And many of those loans have been restructured already, and there's a lot of tension growing between the low-income countries that borrowed and their Chinese lenders. So what are the crises in the making? I think the emerging markets, Some are doing better than others. It's a mixed bag. But definitely the low-income countries, I think, are already going through a very rough spell, also given what's happened to commodity prices. I'll conclude on the lessons. I don't think we learn. I think that's the upshot. We don't learn. We keep saying we learn. We do certain things better. Certainly, I think, as we heard from Larry, the policy response once the crisis erupted was a lot better, especially, I would say, in the U.S. than in certainly in the 1930s. But what we don't learn is that the seeds of crises are sown in good times. Bad loans are made in good times. And it's in those good times that everybody's too willing to say this time is different and to look the other way. And I'll conclude on a very specific note. I think it is misguided to talk about crisis management and crisis resolution exclusively in terms of monetary and fiscal policy. I think the issue of debt restructuring and how you deal with debt write-offs, and I'm not just talking about the, you know, big drama of sovereign write-offs a la Greece, but private debt write-offs is a huge issue. How quickly you clean up the debt overhang is very important. If not, ask Japan, which has had the longest aftermath of a financial crisis that I am aware of historically. I'll stop there.
Thank you for the invitation. I think when I got the invitation, if you told me I was going to be following Larry Summers and this fine group, I might have, and been the last speaker of the day, I might have thought differently about that invitation. But anyway, my remarks are going to be focused on Europe. I'm going to take a slightly different tack from Carmen, although I'm not going to talk as much about debt as she did, but I don't want that to suggest that I don't think that the debt issues are very real for Europe. I also want to say that I hope one of the messages that you get from this is that we do learn a lot from looking at other countries. You know, after the financial crisis, there was this kind of existential, how did macroeconomists miss this? That macro had nothing to say about the crisis, missed it completely. And as an international macroeconomist, I was like, maybe people just need to start attending some international conferences because we're all about crises and all about the role of debt. So anyway, and how financial crises in the financial sector spill out into the rest of the economy. Anyway, my remarks are going to be focused on Europe. And I'm going to try to make the case that the crisis exposed some severe weaknesses that are existing in the common currency arrangement in Europe, and that these weaknesses resulted in a significant difference in the economic recoveries in the United States and Europe after the financial crisis. And I think they tell us something about the kind of reforms that need to be undertaken in Europe if the euro area is going to succeed. So as has been mentioned already, if right after the crisis, if you look at kind of per capita income in the United States, and you take an average per capita income in Europe, it looks remarkably similar. They just line up the depth of the crisis, the timing of the crisis. Where things start to differ is in the aftermath of the crisis. So the U.S. starts to recover, you know, not great recovery, as we know, but even slower in Europe. But more importantly, isn't just the average performance, but if you look at the kind of the cross-sectional, what was happening to different countries. And here you see this widening spread. Some countries are doing quite a bit better. Others doing, and as Carmen pointed out, haven't recovered yet. Greece is the prime example, but not the only example of a European country that is still suffering from the effects of 2008. So it's interesting to think about. If you think of, you know, Europe has a shared currency, common currency area. The United States, if you want to think of individual states, give us kind of a laboratory to think about, okay, we have a common currency too. So what's different between how the common currency is operating in Europe relative to the United States? And there's kind of three possible culprits that I'm going to focus on. One is monetary policy. The other is fiscal policy. And the other is labor markets. So, you know, just briefly on monetary policy, we've talked about this a lot today, and I think it's clear that monetary policy in the U.S. responded quickly, responded aggressively, and it was a sustained response. The ECB took a little longer. In fact, initially went the wrong way, raised interest rates, then kind of recovered and started lowering rates. But I think it's fair to say that when you go back and you read what kind of the policy statements were and how people were characterizing the crisis, you know, it seemed like the Fed was guided by this fear that, you know, we're on the brink of a collapse. This is the worst thing that's happened in the U.S. economy in decades. big things have to happen, and indeed really aggressive and creative things were happening, or policy responses to try to respond to the depth of the crisis. In Europe, it was a little more, well, the crisis happened in the U.S., we're suffering bad spillovers over here, but, you know, it was a little more, we're worried about inflation taking off, a little more carefully. But my point is, whatever the monetary policy response is in Europe, even if they had gotten it, the ECB had gotten it exactly right in terms of timing and the magnitude of the policy shifts, it's only going to be right on average for a country in Europe. It can't address the fact that some countries are suffering much greater economic downturns than other countries in Europe. So monetary policy could only do so much, of course, because it's a common currency, and they only have one instrument to use. So by definition, the elimination of national monetary policy means that other kinds of policies have to step up and be more flexible and take on more of the role in responding. So that could be labor market adjustments, and it could be fiscal policy. And I think this was recognized by the, you know, in the initial stages of the euro, that other things are going to have to do the work if we take away the flexibility of a national monetary policy. And I think the thinking was, too, that with greater and greater market integration, as European economies become more linked with each other, they're going to become more like the United States of Europe, and therefore there will be less heterogeneity, and monetary policy for the average will be more effective. So there's kind of a race between the speed at which European economies become integrated and the speed with which other policy tools, like coordinated fiscal policy, more integrated labor markets, that labor policy, that those things, there's kind of this race between those two processes. Unfortunately, I think before that race got too far down the road, we hit the global financial crisis. So, you know, looking at labor markets, it's pretty clear that, you know, unemployment rates are more persistent in Europe. There's much wider spread in unemployment. There's much less migration in Europe relative to the United States. There's lots of good reasons why labor doesn't move, culture, language, other things. But realistically, labor just doesn't move as quickly in response to wage differentials or unemployment differentials. So labor markets just can't step up or can't do the responding that they do in the United States. And an additional problem is, if labor does really respond a lot, think about what that means. So you get this problem of hollowing out, that, say, unemployment is very high in a place like Greece, and people decide to leave because there are better market opportunities elsewhere. Well, Greece is sitting there with that mountain of sovereign debt. That's just going to make the national fiscal problem even worse for the people that remain. So even though labor markets can do work in responding, it actually kind of exacerbates the debt problems that Carmen has been talking about. So the third thing I just want to quickly mention is fiscal policy. Of course, fiscal policy could step in and do some of the work of trying to mitigate the effects of the crisis. And here, as has already been said, it was just a disaster. So at the time of the crisis, rather than kind of support aggregate demand, instead there was this idea that, well, we're in a, you know, this, we've got these Maastricht criteria, and we've all agreed that we have to follow by these rules. And there was even a kind of a sense that you're setting a good example by being fiscally austere, even in the face of a deep recession, because you're setting a good example for other countries that have to be fiscally austere. So the consequence was austerity across the board. Countries that had the deepest austerity had the deepest declines in economic activity. Now, to be sure, some countries needed to, you know, there's a, Greek has accumulated a lot of debt. They probably weren't in a position to have a very aggressive fiscal policy. But that's not to say they wouldn't have benefited by other parts of Europe being more stimulative. And Europe just did not respond in that way. So I think my conclusion would be that the euro area is going to need substantial reform if it's to survive, that the commitment to the euro is going to require a banking union. I didn't have time to talk about that, but clearly more steps need to be taken in that dimension. dimension, increased labor market integration, and increased coordination of fiscal policy that actually internalizes the effect of fiscal policy on other area countries in the euro area. I want to quote something that someone earlier said today. I think it was John Lawrence said, crises are good for focusing attention on reforms that are needed. I think that's true. I'm not sure that the crisis was deep enough for Europe to really come to grips with the kind of reforms it needs to undertake. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask our panel one question, and then I'll open it up for questions from the audience. And it begins with a reflection that Charles Kindleberger's masterful history of the economic history of the Great Depression concluded that the onset of the Depression occurred as a result of the absence of leadership. He called it the absence of a hegemon, a country that was prepared to enforce the rules of the game, act as a lender of last resort, mobilize collective action among countries. Britain was failing. It was struggling. The United States had turned isolationist and was reluctant to marshal that kind of leadership. Other countries were too small or indifferent. And this is a parallel relevant to today, where the United States seems to be struggling with its question of its own role. And you have a resurgent China and perhaps other countries with similar aspirations seeking to exercise global leadership. And I turn to the panel and say, is the role of hegemony crucial in achieving recoveries from financial crises? What does the long history show? What does the cross-sectional evidence suggest?
Well, I think both theory and history suggest that it's not so much hegemony as cooperation among the major powers. So Charles Kindleberger's original study talked about a single leader. I think most of the evidence is that you could have two or three powerful countries, and in the gold standard period you typically did, as long as they were willing to cooperate in a common aim of stabilizing the international financial or economic order. So I think the lesson is that, yes, the international economy is now not self-equilibrating. The international economic order, markets may be, but the international economic order is not. It's not self-equilibrating. It requires purposive intervention by the major powers, and they need to cooperate. That was successful it has been successful at many points in time. It failed in the 1930s, which was one of the reasons for the Deep Depression. And the extent of cooperation that we saw, especially in monetary policy in 2008-2009, was one of the reasons that the crisis was not deeper than it was. The failure of cooperation in Europe is the main reason why the European crisis was as deep as it was. So I think the essential lesson I would draw is the necessity of cooperation among the major powers.
When we're looking at the 19th, just hold it
up. Yeah. Close to your mouth.
Okay. Now. Yeah. yes. But what I learned from the crisis in the 1930s, is more than the change of the hegemon, but more about the looking inward. The characteristics, the end of the financial globalization was very important. All the countries introduced, in the midst of the crisis, they introduced tariffs. Okay, the capital controls were implemented, so suddenly financial globalization started. So I think that what accelerated, or what it increased, the deepness of this crisis. After a big financial crisis, what you see is countries looking inward, looking suspicious about globalization. So far, what we have seen Yes, we have been observing trade wars, we have been observing capital controls, but it's not of the same characteristics that one that we have observed in the 1930s so far. But I think that that's one issue that deepens every crisis, the looking inward and stopping collaboration and introducing restrictions to everything.
I think I would just say that, as economic, more countries have risen to the, you know, we've got China, we've got, you know, it's not just the United States as the hegemon that could dictate the global order. The hope was that institutions like the IMF and the World Bank would be strong enough to provide some of that leadership, but I'm not sure. I mean, that requires countries like the United States to accept the advice of these global financial institutions.
I'm going to follow up on something Graciela said as well, because I think that these are definitely interconnected. There is a tendency to look inward after crises, and the Smoot-Hawley Act, of course, was the classic everybody cites. But we're seeing it today. We did have Brexit. We do have a trade dispute going on between the two major powers. And European interbank system was significantly fragmented after the crisis. So, you know, there has been, to different degrees, a scaling back of the globalization path. Now, in terms of leadership, I think it's really complicated because I want to go back to what Jeff said about coordination. One of the things that helped cope with a crisis, and Linda mentioned this, is crises were synchronous. Everybody was more or less going into crises right around the same time. But the policy response, especially the monetary policy response, also was synchronous until last year. You know, ECB, Fed, you know, BOJ, all lowering rates, all. Now we're starting to see different paths for different central banks. And this is really important because what it also means is more volatility. One of the features, really striking features of the decade after the financial crisis was a marked historic decline in financial volatility as measured by the VIX or anything else you want to use to measure volatility. That's coming back. Further adding to that, and this is on your question on leadership, China. We cannot underestimate the leadership role of China for emerging markets. Because I think this goes back to what Graciela said. We didn't see a lot of defaults after the financial centers had crises this time. Part of it, I think, was China was also growing at over 10% on average. That made a big difference in terms of leadership for the emerging market segment of the globe, which is now 60% of world GDP, by the way. So we're not talking about peanuts. Finally, on that score, I think that's also more at stake because China's own slowdown right now is just of uncertain magnitude, and the effects of a trade war are also, you know, raising a whole slew of risks that weren't there before. So on the forward-looking part, I think the leadership issue is shaken by both the lack of synchronicity that we're seeing in policies among the Western advanced economies and the fact that we're not so confident that China today is the China that it was 10 years ago when the crisis erupted.
Thank you. We have questions from the audience. Microphones, please. Down front, can someone carry a microphone to one of these folks in the back, too.
So I'd like to follow up on that last comment about China and connect a couple things that we heard. We heard Jeffrey talk about the distributional politics within countries, both debtor countries and lender countries, both resolving debt and paying for it, but then also the concern about China. And in looking forward, we have been hearing for 10 years concern about China's own internal debt problems, particularly real estate related, particularly inland, where there's been not just a lot of public infrastructure spending, but private spending that's not very transparent. Presumably in the Western economy, including in our own crisis, there was a fair bit more transparency. And I'm just wondering, on all of your radar screens, how big an issue is local real estate related debt in China, or has been a lot of it been made in the press and there's not that much there?
Okay, so we have been hearing a lot indeed over the course of the years of a real estate bubble in China. Also, there's various layers to the onion of debt in China, including the provincial debt, which has been restructured to some degree. It's still there. But that actually what I worry most about Chinese debt has a more novel tone, which is their corporates built a lot of debt. They built a lot of debt because, you know, China had an export-led growth model, and China was doing really well on the export front. That's not the case anymore. This is debatable, but you could say the RMB is overvalued, you know, in that all EM currencies have fallen and the RMB is still hanging in there, so they... The corporate debt, I think, is a source of concern, and I think it's very connected to the slowdown. If you look at Chinese current account deficit, except for the U.S., its current account has deteriorated with pretty much the rest of the world.
Stanley Kober. Also for Professor Reinhardt, you said, you tell me how Italy gets out of this one. So let's accept that. Italy is in the Eurozone and Italy is big. Does the Euro then become an efficient method for transmitting Italy's economic distress throughout the rest of the Eurozone?
Oh, boy, Okay, next question. Let me say, Italy, the problem is an old problem. Italy hasn't grown. And while all the other countries were growing before the crisis, Italy wasn't even growing before the crisis. So that is a deep-rooted problem that I think has been exacerbated by lack of competitiveness and the fact that in the old days, in the lira days, periodic devaluations of the lira helped to jumpstart things now and then. So how does Italy's problem get transmitted? It could be, I mean, look, the 2010-11 sovereign debt crisis, which involved Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. Those three countries are less than 7% of Euro GDP. Italy alone is about 15% of Euro GDP and about a quarter, about 25% of Eurozone debt. So the issue of contagion, especially in the context of the other periphery countries, is one that, you know, it certainly, I think, is a very real scary prospect. I was in Spain in mid-December, and certainly when you talk to the business community, I mean, of course, they have their own issues with Catalonia, but, you know, looking at the... prospect of an Italian problem is very real, and that contagion would affect all.
Ira Lieberman, former World Bank staff. I've worked on crises all across the emerging market world. I led the teams in most of those crises, and just one. Publicity. Brookings just published my book on crises called In Good Times, Prepare for Crisis. So I echo what most of you have to say. So my question is one focused on restructuring, which Professor Reinhardt spoke about, and the lack of attention to real restructuring, not only in the banking system, but also in the corporate world. A lot of the work I did was between the banks and the large corporates like the Chaebols on corporate restructuring. I don't see much discussion of that. Also, and just supporting that, we know that in crises, SMEs get cut off, small businesses get cut off, and in most of the emerging market countries, but also in Portugal, Ireland, et cetera, they just went down because they couldn't find any support. They couldn't get any financing. I've not heard anyone talk about that. There's a systemic bias towards the banks. All the central banks know how to deal with the banks. The IMF knows how to deal with the banks. But no one looks at the real sector. Alan Blinder has written about that, too, related to the real estate problem or housing problem in the U.S. in his book, When the Music Stopped. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this issue, the need for fundamental restructuring, and also is there sufficient discussion, analytics, academic work in this area? And then second, about looking in crises also at the real sector, not just the financial sector or banking sector.
I can say something about the European context, which I think one of the disasters on the European front is precisely that there was, with the exception of Greece, no restructuring. And that is still a massive burden, especially in the crisis countries in Spain and Portugal in particular, but also in some Central and Eastern European countries. There's very strong evidence. Portugal has great micro data, and we know that essentially the credit channel remains blocked in Portugal. That small and medium enterprises in Portugal still cannot borrow. The banks are still trying to recover. The restructuring that's necessary, I think, in these cases is on the sovereign side, because basically all the loans were turned into sovereign debt. If there were really systematic restructuring, which in my view is entirely remains necessary in the European context, it would, I think, go a long way towards dealing with some of the underlying systemic problems in Spain, Portugal, and some of the other southern and eastern central European countries. Italy's got bigger problems, but I think if those countries were growing, it would help Italy. Certainly couldn't hurt. So restructuring remains necessary.
I worked on Portugal for the IMF, and particularly on the issue of restructuring, SME and microfirm restructuring, and they totally, after two visits, they totally ignored that advice. And I warned them they'd pay for it, and they had a secondary banking crisis, as you know.
I will take any other question comments, Graciela. Please.
What I wanted to mention is that in crisis of debt in periphery countries, there was a restructuring in the sense that what was private debt became government debt. And when the government restructured, okay, everybody has restructured with them. So this is different from advanced economies. This doesn't happen. That helped, okay, emerging economies. But in Europe, this hasn't happened.
One second, because I really do think you hit the nail on the head in that restructuring is a big part of the emerging market resolution. The advanced economies figure they were too advanced for it. But on the issue of the real sector, I think it is very related to the issue of who gets bailed out. In Greece, one could very effectively argue that the bankers, the foreign lenders, got bailed out, and the real sector, the real economy in Greece, got the short end of the stick.
On that note, I regret to say that we've come to the end of our appointed time. I trust that our panelists would be willing to take private questions up front here for another few minutes if you have burning issues that we're unable to address right now. But I would ask you to join me in a round of applause for our great panel.
And let me thank our panelists and thank all of you for a terrific day. On your way out, please thank the people who make this event work. I see Karen McGrath in the back and Stephanie Abbott, the friends and colleagues at Brookings, the catering staff who are terrific here. Those brookies don't come free, but they're really good. So thank you and thank them.